This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann at Otago Polytechnic in Dunedin, and I am joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How are you on this very rainy day?
Who are we introducing today? Or I should say, we are doing another of our shows in the, what are we calling it, Coming Up for Air series.
We are about a third of the way through our Coming Up for Air podcast, and the next cohort is recorded and lined up, so we keep going on this. So this has been really popular, and it's actually been really interesting listening to all of these. Today we have the very lovely Kaylee Jilks. Kaylee, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi. I'm in Christchurch, so we've got the country covered.
Christchurch. And where did you grow up, Kaylee?
I'm from the UK, so kind of the middle of England, on a small farm.
Which bit?
So near, not far from Oxford, between London and Birmingham.
I do know where that is. I was born in Derby. What was it like growing up there?
Yeah, it was peaceful. We lived, our farm was a mile from the nearest road. So, relaxed and spent a lot of time outdoors. I think my mum said we turned up for dinner if we wanted fed and then went out again.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be what I currently am, which is a veterinarian. So I got there, and now I'm not so sure whether it was the right idea or not, but here I am.
What made you want to do that?
I guess growing up on the farm, with animals all around, we had lots of pets. My grandfather and subsequently my mother took great care of their animals. It was kind of, I guess, a natural progression from that.
So you weren't put off from reading James Herriot's stories?
I have never read James Herriot.
Oh, no. Well, you should do that.
I might be the only vet in the world who has never read James Herriot.
And what brought you to New Zealand?
We wanted a change, so my partner and I came initially on working holiday visas, because why not, we can come for 2 years, and that was 8 years ago. We lasted about 6 months before we changed them to work to residence visas. We're here for the outdoors lifestyle, really.
Is there such a thing as a sustainable vet practice?
No. Short answer.
That's a very short answer. I'm going to have to ask you more.
I currently there is not there is, I would say, argue there's not a sustainable medical practice either, with the amount of waste. We're highly energy intensive. Everything comes in plastic for sterility reasons. There's plenty of reasons for it. But yeah, I would argue that at the moment, sustainable vet practice is a goal as opposed to something that you can actually achieve. There's a lot going on around the world. There's a lot of practices in the UK that are registered with Investors in the Environment and have goals and accreditations and things set by them. There's campaign groups and associations in different countries. Vets for Climate Action in Australia do quite a lot of CPD and things. So there's steps in the right direction. But yeah, at this stage, it's in the right direction as opposed to genuinely sustainable, in my belief.
Is there a professional body such as that, Vets for Climate Action, active in New Zealand?
No. So there's a group as part of the NZVA, like a committee that look at it, but there's no kind of national group or national body at this stage.
What would it take to have such a thing? And what might it do?
What would it take to have such a thing? Probably enough people willing to pay to be part of it, to make it financially viable. And we are a much smaller country, much lower number of veterinarians. So whether that's something that will happen is interesting, but it would bring attention to the issue and potentially education for vets and veterinary practice staff that is probably needed before we can make big changes. I'm currently doing my 501 project, looking at what those changes could be and working through ideas within the company that I work for as to things that we could potentially put in place. But yeah, a lot of the things coming out of the survey is that people don't understand or would need more education to work towards that. So yes, I suspect a body that's provided that kind of education and could gather people's ideas so that others didn't have to think of all of them would be useful.
I don't imagine that people who choose to be vets would be opposed to sustainability. It would be more of a not seeing how.
Yeah, I think that's probably the question would be, is it going to be safe for the animals? So like everyone's going to put the safety of their patients as number one priority. So a lot of the waste that's generated is through keeping things sterile and all the plastic that's used. And so crossing that boundary between what we can do whilst keeping everything safe is probably the biggest hurdle. Yeah, I don't think there would be opposed to doing something. It's just what to do and how to do it.
Let's take your music track, which is Louis Armstrong, What a Wonderful World. What a wonderful song that is. Why this one?
So my grandfather was probably the biggest influence in like interest in the natural world and things. For me, he took us out a lot and introduced us to the different flowers and plants and everything. And this song was played at his funeral, which I couldn't attend living over here. So yeah, it was chosen by my grandmother to be played at my grandfather's funeral.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you do. They're really saying I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They're like much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Kaylee Jilks.
Kaylee, we're going to listen to your podcast now, which is very cool. So what would you like the listeners to know about it before they hear about it? And is there anything in particular that you'd like them to listen for?
So my podcast was talking to Christopher Boyle of Fabrum. Fabrum are a cryogenics company, but they... podcast is focusing on their green hydrogen production and rollout. I think he had some interesting thoughts on generally how New Zealand needs to look at sustainability and emissions reductions and why that is. So that's in the second half of the podcast after we've talked about the green hydrogen, getting into a bit more of why it needs to be done.
Hydrogen, H1, the most abundant element in the universe. It has lit homes, propelled astronauts into space, and famously lifted airships that connected continents. Now it could allow us to continue to travel and transport goods around the globe without the use of fossil fuels.
I'm Kaylee, and in this episode of Coming Up for Air, I spoke to Christopher Boyle from Fabrum to find out more.
Hi, Christopher Boyle, co-founder and chairperson of Fabrum, located Christchurch, New Zealand. Primarily what Fabrum stands for is a group of talented innovators developing technology in New Zealand that's deployed globally to enable clean future energy options. So most of our activity is around reduction of emissions through new technology or better technology. We refer to it as treading lightly, doing more with less for longer. We do a lot of activity in the hydrogen space, and we provide technology right from production of hydrogen gas from water using electricity, electrolysis, using a membrane-free electrolyzer technology. So no palladium group metals in there. I mean, it's pointless trying to offset an emission in one area and trash our globe in another. So hydrogen gas production, liquefaction of that gas, storage, fueling systems, right through to onboard mobility solutions. So we've done a mining decarbonisation project where we're doing on-site hydrogen liquefaction and then fueling of haul trucks. We were converting them from diesel to liquid hydrogen. And Fabrum does everything from liquefier design, fueling system design, onboard fuel storage, and preparing that liquid back to a gas for fuel cells. So, you know, that's one of the core projects we're focused on at the moment. The other one is we're doing composite fuel tanks for aviation. Key thing there is composites are lighter. Storage of liquid hydrogen in a composite tank means you maximize the fuel load compared to the total fuel and fuel system weight. So composites is the best way to do that. We've been working with composites and cryogenics for 20 years. So we're doing a number of tank solutions for vertical takeoffs and long or medium to long range aviation to displace fossil fuels.
As Christopher mentioned, green hydrogen is produced by electrolysis. This was first reported in 1789. It involves passing an electric current through water between the negatively charged cathode and the positively charged anode. This splits the water molecule into two hydrogen atoms which gather at the cathode and one oxygen atom at the anode. Hydrogen can be classified as grey or blue as well as green. Grey hydrogen is generated from fossil fuels through either steam methane reforming or coal gasification, both of which also release carbon dioxide. These same processes can produce blue hydrogen if the carbon dioxide is captured and stored underground. There can also be differences in how green hydrogen is made, some requiring a membrane made of a rare earth metal, and others with no membrane at all, like the one that Fabrum is using. Discovering new ways to produce green hydrogen is an area of current study for many academics. Christopher explained a bit more about membrane-free water electrolysis.
You don't require any of the membrane, so a PEM system or an AEM system, they separate the two electrodes with a membrane, so it lets the ion or molecules cross through that membrane, but you don't get the gas, so you don't get hydrogen going to the oxygen side or oxygen going to the hydrogen side. Those membranes are your palladium group metals. They're the exotic metals that create some of the damage we see occurring globally around the exploration for them or the digging up of them. So the membrane-free stuff is just, think back to your science laboratory experiments at school where you just had a beaker full of water and two electrodes. And that's a crude expression of what it is, but it's basically a simple stainless steel stack with water and electricity through two electrodes to make it so 100% recyclable electrolyzer stacks.
Hearing how keen Christopher was on green production of hydrogen, I asked if Fabrum had anything to do with the other colours.
So the production technology we work with is all green. So it uses green energy. There's a whole conversation around how do you define green energy. We sit there and say, let's talk renewable energy. So sun, wind, hydro, potentially geothermal as well, if it's a circular process. So that's what we tend to work with. And then when you talk about our liquid solutions, our storage and our refueling, we're color agnostic because what the world needs to do is adopt the use of hydrogen, and then we can double down on making sure that that hydrogen becomes green.
So what would be necessary to persuade people to take up hydrogen?
I've got this classic cartoon of three blokes, hats on, sitting in front of a saloon, set sometime in the very early 1900s, three horses tied up to a rail outside, and there's this automobile bouncing down this dirt track, which is the street of this village. And the caption says, well, that'll never catch on. Where are they going to get the fuel from? You know, roll on 125 years and none of us think about where am I getting fuel for my automobile because it's just an infrastructure that exists. So what does it take for us to move to hydrogen as a fuel? It takes technology solutions where you can buy a car or a plane or whatever that runs on hydrogen, but also we remove this anxiety of where's my fuel coming from. So we roll out an infrastructure of fueling. We've started on that journey in New Zealand between HW Richardson and Haringa. They're rolling out fueling stations. Fabrum build the fueling stations for HW Richardson. So over the next 10 years, you'll see an infrastructure across New Zealand of refueling for hydrogen. And we'll remove that little caption of where are they going to get their fuel from. So technology that uses hydrogen and the availability of hydrogen are the two key pieces that need to occur to enable this transition.
HW Richardson and Haringa's fueling stations have been in the news in the last couple of years. The new Haringa fueling station opened in South Auckland on the 23rd of April this year.
According to the International Energy Agency, global demand for hydrogen is growing, but needs to grow faster to meet net zero targets. This requires an investment in infrastructure. Part of this infrastructure is the electricity required to produce hydrogen. I wanted to know how much more electricity we are going to need. I asked Christopher about this. He mentions the Consortium for Aviation Fuel. This is a group of companies working on the development of hydrogen as fuel for aviation.
So part of the Aviation Hydrogen Consortium was trying to identify what's the add-on? What do we require to displace fossil fuels for aviation in New Zealand? And aviation is critical, right? We are displaced from the rest of the world by flight, you know. So it's a fundamental requirement of ours to be connected. If you take flight and heavy freight, et cetera, then you're roughly talking about doubling the existing energy provisioning in this country. And, you know, that's not difficult to do. It's one thing to double the electricity production. You've also got to build out hydrogen production capacity. And previously, building of electricity systems and all that, those high-risk or high-cost early decisions were carried by government because the risk was shared across a country of taxpayers. I think it's foolhardy to think that commerce is going to take that risk on their own. So short answer, double the current capacity should satisfy our needs for the next 30 years in today's thinking. Depends what happens with our thinking of our future needs as well. That might change. Key message is it's possible.
Returning to the uptake of hydrogen, I wondered if just having it available would be enough to persuade people to take it up. People often have a fear of new things. Is this likely to be something that would affect the uptake of hydrogen?
I love referring to the past because there's a lot of learnings from it. But, you know, the Flat Earth Society that said you can't sail around the Earth, you'll fall off the edge. So there was a fear of that. And then when it was proved the Earth was round and you weren't going to fall off, sailing became a thing. I think with hydrogen, the noise around it is it's not safe, it's expensive, it'll never work. So how do you disprove those or overcome those barriers? It's through early adoption and people seeing it being used. The number of times people say, but what about the Hindenburg? It exploded. No, it didn't explode. Well, it burnt. Actually, the hydrogen didn't burn. The hydrogen had well and truly left the Hindenburg before the flames were there. It was actually the resin-clad material that burnt, which was a fossil-based material. So, you know, there's those mistruths that stand in the way of adoption. We just need to overcome those through proof.
A brief interruption. For those who are unaware, the Hindenburg was a German airship travelling from Germany to America in 1937. It caught fire on docking in America. Now back to what Christopher was saying.
I don't think there's a single use of fossil fuel that is not replaceable with an alternate. So battery, hydrogen, e-methanol, e-fuel, etc.
That's good to hear. It gives people hope when there are solutions available.
Climate science has been around for a long time, and the findings are indisputable. Climate change is happening. How did people's awareness affect you when you set up Fabrum?
We set the business up 2004. So 20 years ago, and we were trying to work on technology that most of the world didn't think was necessary. So it's been an interesting journey, you know, where you develop technology the world is sort of arguing that they don't need because they don't perceive the problem. You said that the science has been there for a long time and it's indisputable, but we just don't want to listen to it because it's that change thing. You know, I've got to change my behavior and that's uncomfortable.
When you're in that space where people are maybe not necessarily perceiving the benefit of your product, how do you go about setting up a team to work in that kind of an industry?
We're fortunate in the fact that, you know, we've got 110 people in the team that are committed to influencing a positive shift in our behavior to reduce emissions. I think in every human, there is that goodness or that desire to support a better future. So I don't think it's hard building the team, but it's definitely challenging to fund it in a world where the government doesn't necessarily have a clear mandate on how we're going to move to a reduced emission future. For us, for Fabrum, we don't do this because it seemed like a good idea. It's part of our ethos. And the reality is it has to happen. I keep teasing my team about the best path traveled is the one less taken. And that's what I feel we're on. Sometimes we're having to actually cut the track to traverse it. So it may not be the easiest choice, but it's definitely the most rewarding. Easy and right often are not the same.
That's very true. Talking of the path less travelled, it looks like that path is going to get easier. It has been suggested that the cost of green hydrogen will become much cheaper as the technology improves, we use more renewable energy, and it becomes more commonly available and accessible to business and the public. The emergence of green hydrogen as a fuel source could also alter global geopolitics, as it is not dependent upon having a fossil fuel reserve in your country, just renewable energy and water. In order for these changes to occur and benefit the world, more companies need to be working in this space. I asked Christopher a bit more about his thoughts on setting up Fabrum and making sustainable change in general.
We have a firm belief that if you empower and provide the right conditions and opportunities for people to create change, they will. So, you know, we formed the company on three solid pillars. One was to leverage the very capable manufacturing environment of Canterbury. The second one was to provide a pathway for innovative youth, engineering students, etc., to apply their craft in New Zealand to impact global change of technology adoption without having to leave their home country and miss out on the environment. Because that's why I keep coming back to New Zealand and prefer to live here. It's because we're in this incredible environment. That's also a clear metric of why we're doing this. Because if we don't create this change, this new technology to enable doing more with less for longer, then we're going to lose that environment. And you can go places around the world where they're losing it already. You know, we're on the periphery. We're a little bit down the shuffleboard of consequence, but it will find us. So we need to act. The next generation has a need that we need to ensure is delivered, and that is leave this place in better shape than we found it. It can seem almost overwhelming, but something we do really well here in New Zealand is we take on difficult challenges because we're remote from the world, right? So our whole history is built on the fact that we don't have the luxuries that everyone else has, and we have to come up with an alternate solution for it. I think in our psyche, we're well prepared to accept this challenge. We've just got to start. My greatest fear is that if we don't sort it out, it'll become a polarizing outcome between those that can and those that can't. So it'll drive poverty. You know, it'll be there'll be people left behind, and that's just not acceptable. So we need to act in a way that enables us to move as a group, as a collective, so that no one is left behind, no one's disadvantaged by it. And unfortunately, the current trajectory we're on says the wealthy will prevail and those not so wealthy will carry the burden. And that's not acceptable.
So in order to avoid that, what do you think should be the motivation for the country to reduce emissions?
The motivation is acknowledging that we are in a state of change, necessary change, and that we are delivering the technology, New Zealand technology globally, to support that change. New Zealand's a net energy taker, so we are reliant on offshore supply for a lot of our energy needs. That means we're at the mercy of an international market. The move to a greater electricity generation and green alternates for fueling, for example, hydrogen, EV, etc., actually gives New Zealand an opportunity to become independent of global fuel markets, which has got to be good for us. You know, we get to build our own technology to support our own future. The learning in that technology then gives us an export product, which is good for standard of living for New Zealanders, as well as the higher employment in value jobs, etc. So those are all pluses. That's all in front of us. You know, that's a choice we can make as part of this energy transition. So clear guidance out of a government enables us to do that. But I think it's a challenging future in front of us, but the opportunities for New Zealand are immense and they're really desirable. And the alternate is not great. If we don't achieve change, if we don't figure out how to reduce our emissions, if the rest of the world starts taxing us on emissions against our milk produce or our meat sales, etc., then we will rapidly decline in our state of living in New Zealand because our primary produce will lose value. Therefore, all the feed-on industry that sits alongside our primary produce will be impacted. It'll have a national-wide impact. So doing nothing doesn't just see more emissions. It sees a decay in the New Zealand way of life. And I don't think that's seen by many. The Energy Commissioner or Environment Commissioner has definitely been vocal on it. Climate Commission, sorry. So what we have to actually do is we've got to be cognizant of the path we're currently on and the value of turning slightly right or left, deviating, because it's a significant impact on all of New Zealand, trade, lifestyles, quality of life, etc. So it's a really big discussion, and we're chewing around the edges. No one seems to be bold enough to stand on the desk and state it clearly that if we don't make change, if we don't head towards this great opportunity, the consequences are quite significant.
And do you think we're currently in a position where we could make those changes?
They're all technical challenges. We can engineer solutions for all of these. You know, that's what I believe. But we have to remove greed, waste, consumption. You know, we've got to modify our social measures on what's important.
Those final ideas are big challenges.
The challenge is good, you know. It just requires action. I think people are open to it, but often you've got to make them aware of what's possible, what's available.
So we have one question that we're asking everybody. If you could change one thing right now that would make the most significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
At a bipartisan level, agree we have an environmental or climatic issue and act now. You know, the time for thinking was 20 years ago. The time for action is now. And it's not going to happen while it's a voting policy decision. You know, it's as a country, we need to say we want to fix this. We want to do it now. So now let's put in place that change plan. It's not touchable. It's not reversible. Whoever's leading the country is still going to do this. Let's get on and do it. Now, let's understand what our penalties are going to be under the Paris Accord in 2030 on, and now take that cost and invest it into an infrastructure that supports a reduction in emissions.
So a call to the politicians there from Christopher. Hopefully this is achievable, something we can do, so we can make a difference. Thank you to Christopher for talking to me about this interesting subject. That was this episode of Coming Up for Air. Thank you. Goodbye.
That was really interesting. Thank you very much. What was your big takeaway from the interview? What do you think about the most from it?
I think how optimistic Christopher was. He was very... he believed strongly that we could make changes and sort things out, that the technology that we could use is already here, as opposed to a lot of what you read and what you see that says we're going to rely on this technology but nobody's invented it yet. So I think the optimism that it can be done was inspiring. The downside of his answer to our final question regarding the government and needing to have bipartisan agreement across parties to make emissions changes was, I agree with him. I find it hard to see it happening, which is a little bit disappointing. But I think governments play to the public. So if there's enough public change, hopefully it will lead to the government having to make that decision.
How do we bring these new technologies and these new ways of operating into the public awareness?
I guess that's where the media comes in. More coverage on popular programs, I don't really know what the most popular programs in New Zealand would be. Maybe we need someone on Shortland Street doing something.
I can tell you, with my hand on my heart, that I've watched half of the very first episode of Shortland Street and not a single one since.
Well, you're half an episode more in than I am, so. I guess they show things on the farming program, what's it called, Country Calendar or something like that.
Yep.
But is that watched by people in the cities? I guess it's making people aware of what's out there through the channels that they watch and they listen to. And I guess having conversations about things that you know about. Surprising how many people, when you start talking about things, have an opinion or do actually know something about it. I've got a colleague in my practice who's very much on the same wavelength. So she's on that committee that I spoke about at the beginning of the podcast for NZVA. So between the two of us, we talk about quite a lot of things, and she's now writing some articles for the Vet magazine about sustainability and things that she's come across. So going in the right direction, just needs everybody to have conversations in their area and look at what can be done, what's being done, introduce people to things.
What do you hope will be done? Where's your hopefulness?
I hope that people will see what's happening and realize that they need to make a change. I would like to see people stop buying so much random, useless stuff. It upsets me a little bit every time I hear someone shopping on Temu. I think people understanding their environment more, people getting out more. You see a lot of people going out into the hills, and hopefully those people come back and tell people how much they've enjoyed it, and more people go and see what we're trying to save.
And we are trying to save something that is so precious and so important. And I don't think people realise how close we are to losing it.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know whether we need more horrendous weather events for people to notice, or what it takes for people to really see that it's happening now.
Yeah.
Bubble Sprite of the Forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui, kia koutou, ko tahu hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each who you are. Triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been so tough. And for all of us, we are now in a period of recovery and recuperation. We are tired. And as my manager said, the world is tired. We've been through so much, and yet we must continue. And in acknowledging this, it's important that we find ways each day to replenish our energy stores and to replenish our stores of hope and understanding that we are part of a long-term process, and that we are part of a process on our paradise planet of change, of times of crisis, of times of transformation. And all of this aids us to build together a future that can work even better. I know for myself that I've had so many ups and downs over the last few years, and I think we all have. There's been so much to process, there's been so much to reflect upon and try to find meaning in. And this is something as a species that we do find very comforting. If we can find the meaning, if we can find the patterns, this helps us to feel safe. And sometimes by taking a step back emotionally and looking at a big picture, looking at our history, looking at the history of the planet, we can see that on a micro and a macro scale, often there are cycles of transformation that do require coming to a point of crisis. And this crisis point forces the situation to transform. And I'm sure we've all experienced this in our own lives. I don't think it's something to be afraid of. I think it's something to understand as part of a process, a positive process of positive change. Of course, in our society and consensus reality, these times of crisis on a personal level can be seen as terrifying because those we know and love can change greatly or other aspects of them that we don't know come forward and we see them. But for me, I acknowledge that for each of us in moving through different phases in our lives, getting closer and closer to drawing forth that inner essence that is innate within us all. Sometimes we do move through these moments of crisis and transformation. And when we do, it's such a comfort to be able to see these processes echoed through the living world, through our relations in the living world. Whether it is a chick hatching from an egg, having to break the shell of that egg, whether it is a seed bursting from the seed pot, whether it is a butterfly emerging from a cocoon, having been a caterpillar completely turned to mush within the cocoon and then restructured into a beautiful butterfly. All of these processes help us to remember that times of crisis in our lives will be survived and we will emerge stronger. So, of course, being part of this show is a huge pleasure and privilege. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
Kaylee, you will be coming to the end of your master's journey and you've got a lovely big thesis to write now. How are you feeling about that, and how has your journey been through your master's?
So, yeah, the thesis is going okay. I've done the first round of collection of survey data, and I'm going to run some focus groups. So currently I'm analysing the data that came from the survey areas that vets are interested in, how much they believe that the industry needs to change, or rather veterinary staff, not just vets, how much the industry needs to change, what areas they think it needs to change in, what they would like to see change in those areas, and what they can make a difference in. And yeah, so I will finish analysing that and take the most popular ideas to focus groups from within the company to discuss where we could go with it, whether it's feasible, and try and aim to write that up into some recommendations for management to look at. Hopefully they'll take them on board and implement them, but yeah, so no, it's going reasonably well. I feel like I'm getting there. The coding has been a little bit more intense than I thought it might be for the open-ended questions, but yeah, so it's, yeah, I think I'm on track for getting it done. The journey through the Masters, I'm very glad that I decided to work part-time to do it, because I think I would probably have lost my ability to go out and do the things I enjoy if I had worked 40 hours a week and tried to do the masters on top of that. So I have great respect for those people who are doing that.
Some jobs allow for it, and you know, some jobs you've got more time to sit and think about things while you're working and you can study. But a job like yours, which will be so full on and so intense, there's no wriggle room there, is there?
No, there's not a lot, and the hours that we work, like often I'm finished work at 7 o'clock at night, so the last thing I want to do is come home and then study.
Yeah.
So yeah, having days off in the week where I'm focused on that rather than trying to fit it around the job is probably been hugely beneficial to me. It's also been very good for my mental health, I think, to study something completely unrelated. So it's an area, like business is an area I have not studied. My education when I did my degree was very science based. So yeah, business and the different types of people that you come across doing courses that are not so vocational gives you a more broad appreciation of what's going on in the world and how people are addressing the same issues in different spaces. So I think all of the courses and the papers have been great, but I think the best thing that's come out of it is probably meeting all the different people and seeing all the different things that they're doing in their areas, and the hope that comes from seeing that it's being addressed in multiple situations.
You're on the change team.
Hopefully. We just need that team to get bigger.
When you're explaining what you're trying to do, what's your go-to definition of sustainability?
I guess a lot of what I'm doing is environmental sustainability. So I guess I'm looking at it as reducing our impact on the environment. I guess the reason I'm looking at that side of it is that a lot of the social kind of sustainability is already to some extent addressed in my industry. People talk about it, whether it's working, given the shortage of available vets and things is another matter. But yeah, it is already thought about. So I think it's the areas that are not thought about. But yeah, sustainability in general, leaving the planet and society better than it currently is.
I have some questions to end the show. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Related to sustainability or related to life?
Can be anything you like.
I became a New Zealand citizen. Just in March this year.
That's lucky for us.
So
they can't kick me out now.
Make sure you keep the piece of paper that says you've got it, because for some bureaucratic reason, I've needed to find how I became a citizen when I was about 18, and nobody, not either I nor the government, have any record of it. It is causing lots of trouble. Keep that piece of paper. What is your superpower?
Stubbornness. I'm very, very stubborn. and it might not seem like a superpower, but it's got me up mountains that I probably should have turned around on, and it keeps me battling for the things that I believe in. So yeah, I think stubbornness is probably my superpower.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No, not compared to some people. No, I do my bit, but I probably am not as vocal and out there as people who are protesting and trying to make more people change.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
The need to make a difference, the need to do something. Like, be that at work, looking after the animals, or be that doing something that's hopefully going to make a difference to society in general.
And what's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to, we've got a new vet starting. I'm looking forward to having enough vets to fully staff the practice.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
If you've got something that interests you, even if it's not in the area that you're currently working in, follow it and learn about it, even if you're not going to be doing it, because it makes you feel better.
Thank you for that. Mawira.
Kaylee, thank you very much for your contribution to our shared learning space while you've been doing your study, for your different perspective that comes from the fact that you have lived overseas and grown up in a different culture, and you've brought all of that here. The way that you share your worldview, and the way that you explain your professional practice spaces, that makes what you just blew my mind with some of the stuff that I've learned about the whole practice of being a vet, and things that I'd never thought about ever, and I've become very conscious of now. And I have admiration for anybody who chooses that pathway, because, you know, I've got dogs and I love my dogs so much. Anybody who wants to keep our pets well is a hero in my mind anyway. But I think that we're really lucky to have you in New Zealand, and in particular with your lens on change. So I do think of you as an activist. You're really active in bringing about change, and I really appreciate that about you. So thank you for sharing with us today, and thank you for sharing in our class, and all the best for the near future. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. Now, I have 8 choices for you to pick the music we're going out to. They're all animal themes. That's why I've got so many. So you haven't listened to it, but All Creatures Great and Small theme. Eye of the Tiger. I got the eye of the tiger, the fire, dancing through the fire, cause I am a champion, and you're gonna hear me roar. 3 is Horse with No Name. Four is Nelly the Elephant.
Nelly the Elephant packed her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump.
5 is the Hippopotamus Song for Thunders and Swan.
Mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow, down to the hollow. And there let us wallow in glorious mud.
Marcus Turner's Spider in the Bath.
And here I am, is anyone about? I'm down beside the plug hole and I can't get out. I've been here an hour and a half. Can anybody help a little spider in the bath?
Hippopotamus versus Rhinoceros. Rhinoceros.
They call me the hip hop hippopotamus. My lyrics are bottomless.
Or, last one, what does the fox say?
Then no one knows. What does the fox say?
I think of all of those, either I've been through the desert on a horse with no name, probably the most appropriate with this, the river's dried up and everything else, or I have a tiger, but there's a whole long story behind why that one would be appropriate, but so maybe horse with no name.
We'll have to get you back to hear that story. Thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We broadcast every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This was an episode in our special series coming up for air with the podcast brought to you by Kaylee Jilks. With Wirra Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Ngāti wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.